In our last episode, number 92, what is your woodworking skill level? I said that we're going to do a listener tips episode for number 93, and that's what we're going to do. Hi, my name's Roger Kugler. This is Working at Woodworking Podcast, where I hope to instill in you an urge to reach out to your community to, forget all that stuff. You want to make some money with your woodworking skills, don't you? Yeah, you've been eyeing that new table saw, but, not quite in the budget. You want to make some cash. You can do this. You've been woodworking for, 2 years, 20 years. You can do things. Hang a shingle out. Let people know. Go on social media. Hey, does anybody have any furniture they need repaired? Oh my gosh. Bar the door. People will be trying to break it down. So that's what we're about here at Working at Woodworking. Just helping you set up a small business, a one-person shop where you can make some money and help some people in your community out. Now, I can't say that the response was overwhelming. I didn't get an alert that my server had maxed out in data storage, but what I did get was really, really good listener tips. So we're going to start off with James. James wrote, hand planing versus sanding, final pass prior to applying finish, either poly, varnish, shellac, etc. The difference in surface quality between cut and abraded wood fibers is stark. The cut, planed surface will reflect more light and cool facets appear. The sanded surface is more dull, even when a very fine grit is used. This probably doesn't matter when mass producing widgets, but if you are making fine furniture, that can take a lot of hours to produce. It is definitely worth spending the extra 20 to 30 minutes to produce an incredible finish on the piece. Just to clarify, I am referring to only the final pass prior to finishing here. It's okay to sand before planing to the desired grit level. Just finalize the surface with a thin hand-planed cut to enhance the surface quality. That is a great tip, James. And it's something that's pretty much lost from modern woodworking vocabulary because everybody goes to the sander. We don't think about all those centuries of furniture that they didn't have sandpaper, or if they did, it was really expensive and they didn't want to, waste it on just a kind of a common everyday piece of home furnishing that today can sell for, literally millions of dollars. And if you think about how sandpaper works, sandpaper abrades the wood. It doesn't really cut it. It just wears it away. It beats it until it submits. It just rips the fibers from the wood grain until there's just nothing left to rip. A well-sharpened hand plane, on the other hand, slices cleanly, severs the wood fibers, and it leaves a very unique, very, I think, attractive finish. It's almost a burnished finish. Now, one caveat, if you're doing this, test your finish, your stain, and your top coat for adhesion. Because it would be possible with certain finishes, and I'm kind of thinking waterborne finishes here, that you might not get a real good adhesion. Shellac, no problem. It will adhere to, literally anything. But maybe some of the waterborns, I would definitely do a test piece there. I know that if you sand, really, really high, 600, 800, 1200, and you put some like varnishes on, they may not adhere very well, particularly in turning. You have to be careful with that. Now, I can't help but to remember a video I watched by Frank Klaus. Yes, I know, fanboy. He was making drawers, and he planed each drawer, you know, to fit precisely into the cabinet he was building, and the fronts were just planed immaculately. And then he broke out the sandpaper and sanded everything. So I guess it's just a different taste. I think it would be well worth playing around with hand planing as your final finish. And don't forget the hand scraper. You know, just a scraper card. That could be incredibly effective on producing a very nice finish. Okay, tip number two, the right way to lay down non-gloss, poly, semi-gloss, matte, or varnish, etc. Many old-timers have told me this, and I have come across it in a few other places as well. Only apply the non-gloss finish for the last layer, or two at the most. The final layer should be gloss of the same finish type. This produces the best looking finish. For example, if a 4-coat satin finish is desired, the first 3 coats would be gloss, followed by the final coat of satin. If all 4 coats were satin, the finish would look murky compared to the gloss and satin stack up. Yes, 100% agree. If you're using a satin finish, only use the satin finish as the final coat. The other coat should be gloss. I will admit that 100%. You just get a cleaner, more depth. You can see the grain better. It kind of pops more if only that final coat is satin. And let's think about how satin or matte finishes actually work. With most finishes, when you mix those up, when you add, you know, the boiled linseed oil or the tongue oil and this and that and this other thing, and you mix this all up, you have a really glossy substance. I mean, it literally kind of looks like water. Well, if you don't want that real shiny look, plasticky look, you need to kill the reflection cast by that finish. And the way they do that is that they add very, very, very fine particles of something to a gloss finish. And these particles are flat. They're not spherical. They're flat like plates. And as these plates settle, they kind of align themselves. And as light comes in, it hits those plates and kind of gets scattered, get refracted. And you don't see that gloss. Now, to do this, they have to add that other substance, which costs money. So generally, your gloss finishes are going to be a little less expensive than your mattes or semi-gloss or satin finishes. So you might be able to save a couple bucks just by using the full gloss finish with only 1 coat, maybe 2 coats of the flattened finish as your final coats. Good suggestion. Thank you. Tip number 3. I listened to your episode in which you discussed software for the woodworker. Here is a link for you based on your veteran status. I'll put this in the show notes. This is a link to SolidWorks, which is like an uber fantastic super duper CAD software, computer aided design software. It's online. The SolidWorks people are offering an absolutely incredible deal if you are a veteran of either the U.S. or Canadian forces. $20 a year. Yes, that's right. $20 a year for veterans. Now, SolidWorks is no lightweight. It's probably the top or one of the top, you know, CAD programs in the world. And the last time I checked, it was like $500 or $600 a year because these guys have gone subscription-based, SaaS, software as a service. $20 a year? That almost makes me want to think about buying a Windows machine or maybe even a Mac. Yeah, it doesn't work on Linux, and my machine is so old, it wouldn't run the software. This is for the SolidWorks 2024 release, and it's a powerful piece of software, and you're going to have a machine with some real backbone to it to run this. But $20 a year. I mean, if you're in the market, if you're starting to build your business and you like using CAD, i.e. you're young, man, you ought to think about this. You know, if you're a veteran, you know, if you're not a veteran, oh well, I mean, you have to shell out the bucks. Anyway, thank you for passing that on. I was not aware of this. This is, that is really incredible. Okay, tip number four. A listener tips episode, or even a series, is a great idea for a show. Another topic idea may be sharpening plane blades, chisels, etc. I personally use a combination of diamond and water stones and stropping, but there are many ways to skin a cat. And I'm assuming that he's talking about skinning catfish there and not the other type of cat. I use this tool to objectively measure blade sharpness before and after I sharpen. Edge on up industrial edge tester. It is really fun to use it to optimize my sharpening process through experimentation, and also to determine how much work is required to restore a blade to razor sharp. I find that it saves a lot of time doing more frequent sharpening touch-ups with a semi-sharp blade than waiting for it to become very dull, which requires much more time and effort to restore its edge. This is a really cool tool. If you ever see those YouTube videos on the top 10 coolest tools, Stumpy Nubs, I believe, does that really well. This is a device that's been used in industry for, I'm assuming, quite some time. It measures blade sharpness, and they have a material, they call it a medium, that they hold in a special clamp, and you put your blade upon this material, and there's a scale that measures the downward force that's required to cut through the material. This is really cool. I'll include a link in the show notes. And there's three different models. The most expensive one, at about $250, measures to a 1 gram resolution. So it can tell you how many, within 1 gram, how much force is required to get this blade to cut through this material. And there's other models that measure in 5 gram increments, and also a 25 gram model. It's about $125. Man, if you want to dive into a rabbit hole, I could see hours and hours and hours being spent, you know, using this device. Now, is the device itself going to sharpen your tools? No. It's only going to test how well you are sharpening your tools. And let's face it, how do we test for sharp tools? Well, I typically shave my arm hairs. My wife hates that. But it's easy, it's convenient, and it works. The other method, kind of the tried and true method without self-mutilation, is shaving ingrain pine with your newly sharpened tool. That is a challenge right there. You know, sure, you can abrade some sawdust off of the ingrain pine, but to actually get a clean sliver of cut wood, that takes a really, really sharp blade. Yeah, maybe I ought to do an episode on sharpening. That's a good way of pissing off a whole bunch of people real fast. Okay, let me throw a couple tips in here of my own. I mentioned in the last episode about negative pressure. Jeez, who would have thunk it? In my workshop, since it's attached to my house, I've always struggled with, well, my family has always struggled with me using high VOC finishes. You know, the finishes that work. Wasn't supposed to say that, was I? Yeah, that could be another episode. Anyway, yeah, I use marine-based spar varnish on a lot of, you know, my projects, my canoes. And yeah, it smells. It really does. I use marine grade, oil-based, enamel paint to paint my canoes. And, yeah, it really smells. And we've had various strategy, you know, at the end of the day, I do my painting and my varnishing and we go out to dinner. Because the house smells so much. And I came across this idea that I have a gable fan in my shop that I use to ventilate the attic on really, really hot days. And it's amazing. You have 140 degree air in your attic. Guess where that's going? It's radiating downward despite about 8 inches of insulation in the floor joists. And it makes the shop very warm. I pop that gable fan on. It sucks air up from the eaves and flushes out all that hot air from the attic. And there's a noticeable drop in temperature in my shop. I love the gable fan. I am so glad I put that in like 25 years ago. And I discovered that if I don't allow makeup air in the shop, i.e., crack open a window or a door, that it takes suction from the house itself. Now, this is an old house built in the 50s. It doesn't even know the term airtight. Nope, not in the vocabulary. This thing leaks like a sieve in a winter. And taking advantage of that, if I turn the gable fan on without providing makeup air, let it take suction on the main house for its makeup air, primarily through the wood stove, I don't get any smell in the house. It all stays in the shop and then gets ventilated, you know, outside. Neighbors haven't complained yet. But man, does that work well. It works so well. And by the time the finish is done off gassing, which is 2 or 3, 4 hours, you know, I can go ahead and secure the ventilation, and it has worked out so well. So if you're in that type of situation, maybe a basement, if you could do an air seal, you know, maybe drywall, something in the basement to keep vapors from mitigating up through the floor, and install some type of a fan that you could create a negative pressure in that shop, I think it would be well worth your effort. Another tip that has taken me a very long time to figure out. I've never been the world's greatest painter. And I've never been happy with my paint jobs on canoes. They're just, well, okay, they're not perfect, all right? And it's always really, really bugged me. And I finally figured out that the culprit is too thick of paint. You know, the paint film is supposed to be, what, 3 mils wet? Well, I don't even have a mil gauge, so I don't know. But what I've kind of put together is if you're getting orange peel in your paint job, or a clear finish for that matter, that orange peel, it's kind of bumpy, so to speak. It looks literally like an orange peel. Your coating is way too thick. You need to cut that down. And I've started to do that, and I've got the thought out of my head that I only want to put two coats on this. No, you put as many coats on as is required. That might be six. Six thin coats is going to leave such a better finish than two or three really thick orange peely coats that look like crap. And I haven't tested perfectly, but I think you might actually end up using less paint if you're going with thinner coats. Now, thin coats invite holidays. Those are those little curtains, you know, some people call them, where the paint starts to lose its adhesion on a vertical surface and you get a run. Look for those, and as long as the paint hasn't flashed, a quick swipe with a brush will take those out. You may need to dry your brush a little bit so that it can absorb that excess paint, or leave it alone if it's already flashed, because you can go in with a scraper, a card scraper, and scrape that ridge off and a touch of sandpaper, blend it back in. Perfect. Your next coat goes right over top of it. I've really been working on perfecting my hand painting. Sure, I could use a sprayer, HVLP, but I've been trying to teach myself how to get a really good coat with just using a brush. This is something that I don't know if this is a good tip or a bad tip, but I've had students in my shop, and they're all fascinated with a hand plane. And we go through tuning and sharpening and setting up the plane, and I chuck up a piece of wood in a vise, and they're just itching to get started. And they all start at the beginning, and then they struggle with hand planing. So what I'm going to suggest is that you don't start at the beginning in hand planing. You start at the end, and you plane to the beginning so that your beginning becomes the end, and the end becomes the beginning. Who wrote this? Oh my God, is that awful? Oh yeah, I wrote that. Sorry. Okay, what am I talking about? Don't start hand planing a piece of wood. And I'm talking, in my mind's eye, I'm talking like you're doing an edge. If you're right-handed and you are pushing the plane from right to left, don't start on the right-hand end of the board. Start at the left-hand end of the board. Take a little swipe, 6 inches. Move back six inches and take another swipe. Move back 6 inches. Another swipe, so on and so forth, until you get to the end of the board, or the right-hand end of the board. So instead of starting at what you think the end of the board on the right hand and pushing all the way through the entire length of the board, which virtually never works, start at the other end of the board and work backwards. And whenever you get to that end of the board, now you can push forward and take one clean, perfect shaving off that is absolutely dead flat, and if your technique is good, dead square. I teach that method, and they succeed. They do a wonderful job, but if they're trying to go from the right hand to the left hand, it just doesn't seem to work very well. So I don't know if that's a thing. I am not a hand plane user expert, but that has always worked for me. If I have a piece of wood that's a little too warped or twisted to run it through the planer, even with my ultra secret planing warped board tricks, I grab the scrub plane and, start at the far end and work myself backwards. I like to think that it has something to do with the registration of the 4 foot of the plane on already planed wood, as opposed to the 4 foot registering off of unplaned, uneven wood, which just seems to be counterintuitive. So anyway, suggestion, try it. It might work for you or it might not. I'd love to hear your experience. Okay, last tip. Are you tired of the 9-to-5? Do you long for independence? Have you dreamed of having a small business where you can set your own hours, choosing any 12 hours out of the 24-hour day you want, working 6 or 7 days a week? Well, if this sounds like you, why haven't you started it yet? Maybe you just need a little help, a little advice, a gentle shove. Hi, my name is Roger Kugler, and here at Working at Woodworking, I am available to help you on your journey to a new work life. Maybe you need a tough, hard-nosed drill instructor to get you over the hump. Listen here, you wharf rat bilge puke! You need to get your beep together, son! Or I'm going to rip your head off and beep and beep and beep. Do you hear me, you bollywog piece of excrement? Or maybe you're looking. God, I crack myself up sometimes. Or maybe you're looking for some advice from your redneck uncle. Well, sounds like a good idea. Pretty easy to get city folk to pay good money to get you to do something they could do if they knew how to use a hammer and duct tape. Shoot, I bet you could make $1 million doing that. Or perhaps you need something in between. Check out our coaching options at workingatwoodworking.com. Call or email so we can get your new career underway. Okay, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Miss Jobs, a brick company, that's right, a brick company, contacted me. They needed some frames, I'm assuming, to display some of their products. These were like 16 inches by 24 inches. They have a bottom, so it's not like a picture frame. It's a piece of plywood that has a wood frame around it, a border. And they needed these in like lots of 200. And it's like, yeah, no. there is no way I'm taking that on. I could do it. It would actually be kind of fun. It would be repetitive and boring, which means that it would actually pay pretty well. I don't have time. I have too many irons in the fire right now. But that's an example of the type of jobs you can get when you hang your shingle out. You register on Google Business. You build a website. People can find you through search engine optimization, and you don't need to be a super expert at doing that. You just need to kind of get the basics in there and allow people to find you. Recommendations for this episode, I've got a link in there for the SolidWorks for veterans. If you are a veteran and you are into CAD design, boy, and you're a Windows or Mac user, I think that's a no-brainer right there. And if you're interested in the deep, dark hole of sharpening, the edge on up sharpness testers. I've got the link in there. That's actually being sold by sharpeningsupplies.com. Fantastic website. I've talked to those folks, really knowledgeable, friendly folks. I would encourage you to check them out if you're in the market for any sharpening supplies. Special thanks to listeners in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, and Brackley, Northamptonshire, England, and our one listener in Belize. Really appreciate that, and until next episode, happy woodworking.